Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Alice Bryant, Anna Mateo, and Jonathan Evans. Later, Ashley Thompson and Katie Weaver have a special report on one of America's national treasures. But first, this report.
Savannah College of Art and Design, or SCAD, is a private university in the American state of Georgia. In 2003, Sarah Luthens believed it would be the best place for her to study painting. But after 2 years there, Luthens found she wanted more creative freedom. She decided the Virginia Commonwealth University, or VCU, in Richmond, might be the right place for that. So Luthens decided to transfer to VCU before the start of her third year. That is when her difficulties started. Most students in the United States who transfer expect the class credits they have already earned to count at their new school as well. But this was not the case for Luthens. VCU and SCAD credit classes differently in some cases. When Luthens started at VCU in 2005, she learned that the school would not accept about 25% of her credits from SCAD. Less than a year later, Luthens decided to leave school completely. When she returned to her education, she went to SCAD. In 2009, she received her bachelor's degree. She says she learned a hard lesson along the way.
I would not have transferred at all if I knew what it was going to be like personally, if I knew that I was going to lose what started off as 1 year, eventually 3 years, before going back and finishing my degree. I wouldn't have done it.
Luthens is among many U.S. college students to have faced such difficulties. Increasingly, research shows that transferring schools is a complex process that costs many students time and money. The U.S. Government Accountability Office, or GAO, researches how different American institutions operate. In August, the GAO released a study of the student transfer process in higher education. The research found that of all the students attending a U.S. college or university between 2004 and 2009, about 35% transferred at least once. The study showed that, on average, schools receiving transfer students rejected about 43% of their academic credits. Melissa Emery-Aris is the director of Education, Workforce, and Income Security Issues at the GAO. She says differences in academic requirements among schools is a main reason students lose credits. So students sometimes have to retake classes.
A college may say, I see you've taken biology, we're going to give you a general credit as having taken that class, but we're not going to count it towards your biology major at our school because we don't think that the class was very rigorous.
Students transfer for many different reasons, Emery-Aris notes. In some cases, they simply dislike the social or academic environment, like Sarah Luthens. Others might change for financial reasons. Emery Aris says it is especially difficult when students try to move between schools that do not have a transfer agreement. Such agreements let students move their credits from one school to another more easily. But the GAO study found that many schools do not provide information about such agreements on their websites or through other easily available resources.
Emery Aris says this is of special concern for students facing financial difficulties. Students who depend on federal financial aid, for example, are limited in time. They are given only 6 years to complete their degree. At that point, federal support ends. So it is important they know exactly how many classes, if any, they will have to repeat. Leticia Bustillos is the Director of Policy Research at the nonprofit Campaign for College Opportunity. She argues that colleges and universities have a responsibility to support low-income students through the transfer process. But, she says, many schools are stuck in the past.
Colleges overall still adhere to a very traditional model of higher education that no longer exists because the population is different.
Bustillo notes that the new generation of U.S. college students includes many who are the first in their families to seek higher education. Many of them depend on two-year programs at lower-cost community colleges as the first step towards a bachelor's degree. For example, the state of California has one of the largest college student populations in the country. The Campaign for College Opportunity found that about 70% of all college students in California attended community colleges in 2015. Bustillos says that many of these students plan to transfer to four-year schools. That kind of student population has been growing for years. In fact, California passed a law in 2010 to help ease the transfer process because of its increasing popularity. The law lets students who earn 60 credits at California community colleges transfer to any school in the California State University, or CSU, system. They then need just 60 more credits to earn a bachelor's degree.
However, even with this program in place, transfer students still face problems, says the Campaign for College Opportunity. Many of the community colleges lack the resources to offer all 60 credits worth of classes students need to transfer. Also, not all schools within the University of California system accept all credits earned at community colleges. As a result, community college students generally spend more to get their four-year degrees than students who begin at four-year colleges. The difference can be as much as $38,000. Faye Huey of the research group National Student Clearinghouse says such problems are not limited to California. In a recent study, her organization found that the complexity of the transfer process harms low-income students across the country. Huey says it is often because they are starting from a difficult financial position.
Low-income students have limited resources. For example, they could be working in addition to trying to go to school. All students who want to transfer have to take time to look into the different schools that they want to transfer to. They need to do research on the transfer process. And low-income students may not have that additional time to put into their research.
That is why Emery Aris, Bustillos, and Huey all urge public and private universities to work harder to make the process simpler. and the GAO report supports their call. It suggests that the U.S. Department of Education officially require schools to clearly explain on their websites any transfer agreements they have. And the Campaign for College Opportunity wants California public universities to make their general education requirements more similar. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. In most parts of the United States, the month of October brings tasty foods such as pumpkin pie and apple cider. But it also brings scary creatures such as witches and monsters. Some say those creatures appear on October 31st, known as Halloween. For those who celebrate it, Halloween is the day to scare or be scared. One popular activity is to go to a haunted house. A haunt means the spirit of a dead person, a ghost. Some people claim that their houses are haunted by people who used to live there. They say they hear mysterious footsteps on the stairs or find objects in places where they did not leave them. On Halloween, some American towns also create haunted houses to frighten children and adults alike. They are invited to enter a dark doorway, only to be terrified by people dressed as ghosts and vampires. This is considered entertaining. The word haunt also has a non-scary meaning. As a noun, haunt is a place where you often go. In other words, it's your hangout. This usage comes from an old French word of the early 14th century, meaning place frequently visited. Now, if something comes back to haunt you, it causes trouble for you as time passes. For example, skipping school often comes back to haunt students. Skipping school will cause problems for the student later on. You can also say a bad thing you did or a bad decision you made comes back to bite you. Both phrases mean basically the same thing. Feel free to use come back to haunt you in any situation, either official or casual. However, save come back to bite you for a more informal situation. Now, let's get back to being haunted. When we think about something all the time in a way that makes us sad or upset, we can say we are haunted by that thought or image. Here is an example. For the rest of his days, he was haunted by the look on his lover's face before she fell from the waterfall to her death in the raging river below. To use haunt in this way, the memory must be sad or upsetting. No one has ever been haunted by a happy memory. Let's hear these words in an everyday conversation.
So, Magdalena, this restaurant is my favorite. I come here all the time. It's one of my haunts. If you like burgers, I would order the... Are you okay?
Yes, I'm fine. I'm fine. It's just that my ex-boyfriend loved burgers.
Oh, I'm sorry. Then... how about the Caesar salad? Oh, let me guess. He loved Caesar salad too?
No, his name is Caesar. Oh, Ricardo, please forgive me. You see, that's why I moved to Seattle from Brooklyn. I needed the distance. I'm running away from his ghost.
A ghost? Oh no, how did he die?
Well, he didn't actually die. I mean, our love died. He was the love of my life. But one night, I made a bad decision. I kissed someone else, his best friend.
Well, yeah, that was a really bad decision. Bad decisions like that one usually come back to haunt you. Did he find out?
Every time I looked at him, I thought about it. My guilt haunted me day and night. So I told him everything. I knew that he would forgive me. The thing I love most about him is that he is so forgiving.
He broke up with you, didn't he?
Immediately. I mean, he left and never looked back. But not me. I could not even live in the same city. Every place I went, I was haunted by the memory of us. The movie theater where we went on our first date. The store where we bought cat food for his cat. The bank where we cashed in our loose change every Saturday morning.
Wow, that's tough. Moving sure sounds like a good idea. You know what? Forget about all the burgers and Caesar salad. Let's order a big pizza.
He used to work in a pizza shop.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
Indigenous wildlife officials in Australia have found new evidence of one of the country's rarest and most mysterious birds. It is called the night parrot. The bird was thought to be extinct until a sighting in 2013. There have been very few sightings since. But wildlife workers say they have photographed one of the birds in the Kimberley area of Western Australia. The photograph is unclear, an object colored light green and yellow, but officials believe it suggests evidence of a new population of night parrots. They captured the image using a motion sensor camera in Western Australia's Great Sandy Desert. Before 2013, scientists did not know what the birds sounded like. But then a night parrot was found in the state of Queensland. Until recently, the colorful bird had not been seen in Western Australia for more than 100 years. The night parrot lives near the ground and is only active at night. The bird was thought to have died as a result of loss of habitat, fires, and attacks by wildcats. The cats threaten the survival of more than 100 species native to Australia. They are thought to have killed off many other birds and smaller mammals. Alexander Watson is a biologist at the Animal Conservation Group, WWF, Australia. He has worked with Aboriginal wildlife workers in the Great Sandy Desert of Western Australia. He says it is an extraordinary discovery.
We brought equipment like sensor cameras and bioacoustic devices to listen for the night parrots. And extraordinarily, we've got a photo of a night parrot flying across one of the sensor cameras. It's a small green parrot with a yellow belly and large head. it could only be a night parrot. We surveyed in areas that the traditional owners knew there were night parrots there.
The night parrot is sacred to Australia's native population. Experts say Australia now has a second chance to save a bird that was once thought extinct. Officials are not telling the public exactly where the recent sightings happened to help protect the birds. Researchers hope that more night parrots will soon be found in other parts of Australia. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Today, we visit a national park that stretches across two southern U.S. states, Tennessee and North Carolina, and two mountain ranges, the Blue Ridge and the Appalachian. The area is known for its wildflowers, autumn colors, waterfalls, and black bears. It is also known for the blue-colored mist that hangs above mountain peaks and valleys. It looks like smoke and gave the area its name. Today, we are exploring the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. We are hardly alone on our journey. The Great Smoky Mountains National Park gets more visitors than any other.
Starting in the 1920s, local citizens began working to protect the land. Anne Davis moved to Knoxville, Tennessee in 1915. She soon came to love the Great Smoky Mountains. In 1923, Davis visited some of the national parks in the western United States. She proposed creation of a national park to protect the Smokies after she returned home. Anne Davis entered politics to help push the idea. In 1925, she became the first female from her county to serve in the Tennessee State House of Representatives. She proposed a bill to permit the purchase of more than 30,000 hectares of land from the Little River Lumber Company. That was the first huge purchase of land used to create the national park. In 1934, Tennessee and North Carolina gave the federal government more than 300,000 hectares of land for the park. The Great Smoky Mountains National Park was established on June 15, 1934. But the official dedication did not take place until 1940, when President Franklin Roosevelt spoke at a ceremony within the park. The ceremony took place at the Rockefeller Monument, on the border between the two states that provided the land. Roosevelt said that day, "It is good and right that we should conserve these mountain heights of the old frontier for the benefit of the American people."
Most years, around 9 million people visit the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. It is the largest area of protected land east of the Rocky Mountains, and it is one of the few national parks that is free to enter. The park has over 1,000 kilometers of trails, more than 110 kilometers of the world-famous Appalachian Trail cuts through the Smokies. So, you might share the trail with a hiker in the middle of a months-long walk from Georgia all the way north to Maine. Visitors also share the park with a large population of black bears. The park is one of the biggest protected areas in the eastern U.S. where wild black bears live. Black bears once roamed a huge part of North America, but the populations suffered because of habitat loss. Scientists say around 1,500 black bears live in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Park officials work hard to protect them and warn visitors not to get close to bears or leave behind trash that would harm the bears.
Many visitors come to the park to view wildlife. One of the most popular places to do so is in an area called Cades Cove. Here, visitors can see white-tailed deer, the dog-like coyote, turkeys, and yes, black bears. Cades Cove is a valley. It has a long and rich history. The Cherokee Indians used to hunt there. The first European settlers arrived in the early 1800s. In the 1830s, around 270 people lived in Cades Cove. Today, many kinds of historic buildings and structures remain in the valley, including log houses, barns, churches, and a working mill. Cades Cove is also an excellent place to view wildflowers. The park is famous for its wildflower diversity. Within the park are more than 1,500 kinds of flowers, more than any other national park in the country. Another famous spot in the Great Smoky Mountains is Clingman's Dome. It is the highest point within the park. At the top of the 2,024-meter-tall mountain is an observation tower. It offers viewers a 360-degree view of the Smokies and surrounding areas.
Unfortunately, the park has faced air pollution problems. The pollution harms the views atop Clingman's Dome and other scenic spots in the park. The Cherokee Indians who lived in the area used to call these mountains Shakonajee, which means place of the blue smoke. Today, the blue-gray smoke that surrounds the mountains is no longer pure. Some of it is just air pollution. Most comes from electric power centers and cars. The pollution damages native plants and water streams. It also affects the views from the scenic overlooks. It can make the mountain colors appear less bright and beautiful. The National Park Service suggests that visitors by car consider using public transportation from the city of Gatlinburg, Tennessee. A trolley car takes visitors to many stops within the park. The millions of visitors to this beautiful part of America have a special responsibility to preserve the land that many worked so hard to protect. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.